Now, global warming might be making us nervous at the moment, but from 1810 to 1819, people couldn't quite figure out why the Earth became so cold. For an entire decade, the Earth cooled almost a full degree Fahrenheit, and 1816 was known as the year without a summer. Now, until recently, scientists weren't quite sure why. They pointed to the eruption of an Indonesian volcano in 1815, but that didn't explain why the previous years were also colder. Well, now, newly uncovered evidence in the ice packs of Antarctica and Greenland suggests another volcanic eruption may have caused this worldwide dip in temperatures. Jihong Koldai led the research team. He's an associate chemistry professor at South Dakota State University, and he explained how a volcanic eruption could cool the Earth.
When the volcano erupts, it sends out large quantities of chemical gases. One of the gases is sulfur dioxide. When sulfur dioxide is in the atmosphere, it's converted to sulfuric acid, which forms aerosols. These aerosol particles tend to reflect sunlight, and so when you have large quantities, the Earth is cooler because some of the sunlight that normally would reach the surface of the Earth is reflected.
But can it have an impact for an entire decade? I mean, 1810 to 1819, all that just from a volcano?
Well, usually the aerosols can stay in the atmosphere for up to about 3 or 4 years. So for the entire decade to be cold, if it's caused by a volcanic eruptions, then one is probably not enough.
So basically, you figured out that there had to have been at least more than one. We knew about the Indonesian eruption, Tambora. But where was this volcano?
We really don't know. Our research uses the snow and ice samples from the poles. We found the sulfuric acid in the Greenland ice has this special signature that tells us that the sulfur must have gone through the stratosphere, which is to the high level of the atmosphere. The second piece of evidence we found was that the timing of the sulfuric acid at the both poles were exactly the same. So with these two pieces of evidence, we can say that the volcano must be somewhere near the equator, or what we call the tropics, and it must be large enough to cool the Earth.
When you read those ice cores in the poles, how could you be so sure that what you were reading happened in 1809 versus 1815?
A natural level of sulfuric acid can be found in polar snow. And it just happens that in the summertime, the snow would have slightly more sulfuric acid than the winter snow. So we can see this pattern of high and low. And so by counting these layers, we can pinpoint the age of a snow back to the year of 1809 and 1810. And that's where we found the sulfuric acid from the volcanic eruption.
Professor Koldai, as you know, negotiators from around the world are meeting in Copenhagen for the climate talks, and I'm wondering if we can learn anything from your studies. I mean, in theory, if sulfur cooled the planet before, could it somehow be used to cool the planet again?
Yes, at least in theory, it is possible that if you put sulfur into the stratosphere the same way that a volcano does, it will stay in atmosphere for a number of years, and while it's there, it would have a cooling effect on the planet.
That's Jihong Koldai. He's an associate professor of chemistry at South Dakota State University. Professor Koldai, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Rising carbon emissions could be good news, but just temporarily, for lobster lovers. A new study published in the journal Geology shows that if CO2 levels were to soar, the changes in the world's oceans would cripple many species, but might result in lobsters 50% bigger than normal. Now, before you make those reservations at Red Lobster or start clarifying vats of butter, you should know that those supersized lobsters probably won't last very long. And to explain why, we're joined by the scientist who oversaw that study. Justin Rees is an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Guy. Thanks for having me.
Explain how higher CO2 levels in the ocean actually produce bigger, much bigger lobsters.
Well, we hypothesize that the lobsters have the ability to control the type of carbon that's adjacent to their shell and therefore that they use to build their skeletons. So when you increase CO2 in the atmosphere, you actually increase the amount of carbon in seawater, so you increase the amount of material they're using to build their shell. But for most organisms, this is in the wrong form. We hypothesize that the lobsters have the ability to convert that carbon back into a form that they can use in shell building.
Justin Reese, that sounds pretty good, I guess, right? I mean, bigger lobsters means better yields for the industry, the seafood industry, maybe better prices for consumers, right?
Well, it's a little more complicated than that. And the reason is because this pH control, and therefore this control of the type of carbon they use, may require them to divert energy from other physiological processes like tissue growth and reproduction. So they may be able to maintain elevated levels of calcification under CO2 acidification, but it may come at the expense of other processes. And this could be a very bad thing for lobsters. Another component of this story is that if less CO2 tolerant species within the ecosystem and within the lobster's food web, like clams, for example, one of the main prey of lobsters, they had a very negative response. And if their shells become thinner and they become exploited by lobsters and crustacea that are now able to prey on them more effectively, their prey could ultimately, the populations could decline. And even though the lobsters are building stronger shells, their populations would probably be sure to follow.
How did you do this research? I understand that you did this in a controlled environment. Obviously, you didn't do this in the ocean. Describe what you actually did.
We took seawater and we bubbled it with mixed gases that were formulated at the CO2 levels that are predicted for the future. And we grew the organisms for 60 days under these future high CO2 scenarios. And then we measured how the organism's rate of calcification changed over that 60-day period. And the way we did this is we actually measured their buoyant weight, which is a standard method for measuring just the weight of the shell.
So you build these tanks, and you have these. Each tank sort of predicts what the carbon levels will be in the ocean in 100 years from now, 200 years from now, and beyond. The lobsters did well. Some of the other crustaceans did well. Which organisms didn't do well?
That's a great question. The organisms that didn't do well generally were the coral we looked at and the mollusks. Clams, quahogs, the clam they use in clam chowder, a bay scallop, the American oyster, and a soft clam. And actually, six of these species began to dissolve under the highest CO2 level. That means over the 60-day period, their shell weighed less at the end than at the beginning. And this suggests that given sufficient time, these organisms could lose their shell completely. Now, in general, the marine seafloor is a very tough place to live. It's rife with intense predation. And in order for you to survive on the seafloor, you need to be able to protect yourself from predation. And one of the main ways organisms do that is to build their shells. If they lose these shells, they're not going to be able to protect themselves from the highly predatory marine seafloor.
Justin Reese is a marine geologist at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. His new study on how rising carbon levels affect marine organisms is in the latest issue of the journal Geology. Justin Reese, thanks.
Thank you very much, Guy.
And you can get a look at the supersized lobsters that Justin Reese grew at our website. That's npr.org. It's been 40 years since the invention of what we now know as the Internet. And over the last few weeks, we've been exploring the people and ideas behind the network. It's our series, The Net at 40. Now, when you type in a web address, say my personal favorite, npr.org, you should thank a man named Paul Makapetris for making it all so easy. Dr. Makapetris developed a system that associates a string of numbers with a name. For instance, the IP address of npr.org is this, 216.35.221.77. You can type either one into your internet browser and get NPR's website. But it's much easier to remember npr.org. It's called DNS, the domain name system, and Dr. Makapetris joins me from Paris. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Makapetris, how did you come up with this idea? I mean, were you asked to do it?
I was actually given the job of taking five different proposals and harmonizing them together, and nobody noticed that I did something completely different.
When was this?
The system was first used in 1983 and I think was in production use in about 1986 or so. In the early days, we had a lot of freedom to experiment with it, so the system was recognizable as we know it in 83.
And before that, you had worked on something called the ARPANET, which we've talked about on this program, this sort of computer-to-computer network, the first computer-to-computer network that was created at the Pentagon in the late 60s.
You know, I tend to think of that as sort of the dinosaur age, and 1983 was the year that we had a big change over to IP, TCP, and DNS, and all of these new protocols. It was sort of the start of mammals on the internet. It was a very heady time because people basically took the experience they had of the ARPANET and just completely redid everything with a clean sheet of paper.
So until that point, if you wanted to communicate with another computer, you had to be part of the same network. It was almost as if you spoke English, you could only speak to other English speakers. The internet enabled people who spoke several different languages to communicate.
Or another way to think about it is that it might be the difference between different airlines and buses and boats and so forth. With the internet, you can get up, take the first part of your communication over a wireless network like the bus, and then you can go to an airport and get on a long-haul network and then get off and take a train at the other end. The whole idea is it made all of these different ways of transporting data work just as we would expect you to be able to take a trip on a conventional transport system.
And because of those changes, you had to come up with this domain name system, right?
Well, everybody that wants to play on the network, whether it's to have an email address or to connect a computer, needs a name for that. And I foresaw at the time that there might be 50 million of those one day. And so we designed to meet that goal, or at least that's the goal that I had in mind when I did it. Now, today things have grown to probably several billion different names. Because remember, it's not just machines. It's also individual email addresses or any of the identifiers.
So will we reach a point when it's saturated, when the system that you created can no longer handle the amount of names?
Well, if you think of sort of geography, there's only so much beachfront land that you can find, but there's an awful lot of addresses still. The same thing is true with domain names. Some people argue that the ones that they really want are already taken, but if you're willing to settle for a second or third choice, there's probably more domain names than there are people on Earth, phone numbers, automobiles, and pets put together.
Do you remember the first domain name that you made?
Well, I was doing the work at ISI, so I'm sure it was isi.edu. That was part of the University of Southern California.
And was there a number attached to that?
100052, I believe.
So do you get a cut every time someone registers a domain name?
A friend of mine said I was smart enough to invent the DNS, but not smart enough to own it.
That's Dr. Paul Makapetris. He's the inventor of the Domain Name System, or DNS. He joined us from Paris. You can listen to and read more from our series, The Net at 40, by typing in our domain name. That's npr.org. Dr. Makapetris, thanks for joining us.
Happy to do so.
Kevin Blackstone, I know your online presence has got to be making you the big dollars.
Yeah, right, sure.
Well, Kevin may not yet be an internet mogul, but for now, you're still coming around to this program to talk sports. Kevin is a columnist for AOL Fanhouse and a frequent panelist on ESPN's Around the Horn. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's start with the Heisman Trophy.
Sure.
It's the biggest individual honor in college football, but for most of the season, there were no clear-cut standouts. It took a really long time for the picture to clear up.
We thought one person would be Tim Tebow, who's won it once. He did not have a fabulous season. We thought another one would be the defending Heisman Trophy candidate, Sam Bradford, the quarterback at Oklahoma. He got hurt twice, and his season was over. And now we have a pretty muddled picture, but we'll get it much clearer tonight.
Tell me a little bit about this defensive lineman, the man
you
whose
pronounce
name...
it.
No, you pronounce it.
Ndamukong Suh,
from
I believe. Is that close?
That's close, from Nebraska.
Right.
And do you know the origin of his name?
I believe it is Cameroonian.
He's
fabulous. I was at the Big 12 championship game last weekend in Dallas, and he had 12 tackles, I think, 4.5 sacks, and absolutely dominated the game, unlike any defensive player I've seen in a long time. But I don't think a defensive player this year is going to win this award. Nebraska is too ordinary a football team, and I don't think Heisman Trophy winners, especially if you're a defensive player, are going to come off of an ordinary football team.
Kevin, I want to ask you about Toby Gerhard. He's an interesting story. What did you know about this kid before the year got started?
Not much. I knew he was very productive, and I had heard he had been the best running back in high school history in the state of California. But other than that, I didn't know much about him. And now you look, and he's absolutely fabulous. He's
playing for Stanford, not a powerhouse, traditional powerhouse football
right,
team.
Right, exactly. And he's had fabulous game after fabulous game this year, over 1,700 yards rushing, 26 touchdowns. And when he was on national television against Notre Dame, ran for over 200 yards and scored 3 touchdowns and showed speed, agility, and strength, all the things that you'd want in a running back.
So is he the front runner?
I think he's the front runner. You know, the interesting thing, though, about Toby Gerhard is that he does not fit the stereotype of a running back because he's white. And so all of a sudden everybody's comparing him not to any running backs that are stars in the NFL right now, but they're going all the way back to compare him to people like John Riggins, who was the last really great white running back in the NFL. I think that's going to hurt him in some respects, but I think that he is the front runner, and I think the Heisman would do itself a disservice by not giving him the award this year.
When was the last time in your memory that a school like Stanford won a Heisman, had a player who won a Heisman?
Well, I think you have to go a ways back because the big schools obviously get the best talent and they're the ones who everyone pays attention to. But, you know, Stanford did produce Jim Plunkett way back in 1970 and he did win the Heisman. I think it helps a lot when you're a small school in a large power conference like the Pac-10 because that way other people do get to see you play and they pay attention to your numbers, and that's what's happened with Toby Gerhard.
And Stanford has produced some great athletes, and one of those athletic alumni, of course, is Tiger Woods.
He is.
Who we can't avoid talking about this week. He announced that he would take an indefinite break from pro golf, and he admitted his infidelity for the first time. How much damage will this do to his career in the long run?
I don't think it'll do a lot of damage to his career in the long run, but what it's going to affect is his image. I don't think that anyone will ever be able to look at Tiger Woods quite the same. There is such a disconnect between the person we thought Tiger Woods was and the person he now appears to be. And, you know, I think back to one of these great quotes by Lord Acton about someone's secret life and how secrets degenerate. And this is a clear case of a secret degenerating or devaluing someone. And that's clearly what's happened to Tiger Woods. And that's what he's got to get back together.
Kevin Blackistone is a sports columnist with AOL Fanhouse and a regular here on our program. Kevin, good to see you again.
Thank you.